Chapter 7. The Joy of Collops. Mr. Bent goes out to lunch. The Dark Fine Arts. Amateur Thespians, avoidance of embarrassment by. The Pen of Doom. Professor Fleed gets cosy. Lust comes in many varieties. A Hero of Banking. Cribbins's cup runneth over. The sun shone through the window of the bank's dining room onto a scene of perfect pleasure. "You should sell tickets," said Adora Bell dreamily, with her chin in her hands. "People are depressed, would come here and go away cured." "It's certainly hard to watch it happening and be sad," said Moist. "It's the enthusiastic way he tries to turn his mouth inside out," said Adora Bell. There was a gulp from Mr. Fusspot as the last of the sticky toffee pudding went down. He then turned the bowl over, hopefully, in case there was any more. There never had been, but Mr. Fusspot was not a dog to bow down to the laws of causality. "So," said Adora Bell, "a mad old lady, all right, a very astute mad old lady, died and gave you her dog, which sort of wears this bank on its collar. And you've told everyone that gold is worth less than potatoes. And you broke a dastardly criminal out of your actual death row. He's in the cellar designing bank notes for you. You've upset the nastiest family in the city. People are queuing to join the bank because you make them laugh. What have I missed?" "I think my secretary is, getting sweet on me. Well, I say, secretary, she's sort of assumed that she is." Some fiancés would have burst into tears or shouted. Adora Bell burst out laughing. "And she's a golem," said Moist. The laughter stopped. "That's not possible. They don't work that way. Anyway, why should a golem think he's female? It's never happened before. I bet there haven't been many emancipated golems before. Beside, why should he think he's male?" And she bats her eyelashes at me. Well, that's what she thinks she's doing, I think. "The countergirls are behind this. Look, I'm serious. Trouble is, so is she. I'll have a word with him. Or, as you say, her." "Good. The other thing is, there's this man." Amesbury poked his head around the door. He was in love. "Would you like some more minced collops, miss?" he said, waggling his eyebrows, as if to indicate that the joy of minced collops were a secret known only to a few. Fortunately, this is the case. "You've still got more," said Adora Bell, looking down at her plate. Not even Mr. Fusspot could have cleaned it better, and she'd already cleaned it twice. "Do you know what they are?" said Moist, who'd settled again for an omelette made by Peggy. "Do you?" "No, nor do I. But my granny used to make them, and they are one of my happiest childhood memories, thank you very much. Don't spoil it." Adora Bell beamed at the delighted chef. "Yes, please, Amesbury. Just a little more, then. And could I just say that the flavour could really be brought out by just a touch of gar—"
"You are not eating, Mr. Bent," said Cosmo. "Perhaps a little of this pheasant."
The chief cashier looked around nervously, uneasy in this grand house full of art and servants.
"Yeah, I want to make it clear that my loyalty to the bank is beyond question, Mr. Bent, of course."
Cosmo pushed a silver tray toward him.
"Do eat something, now you have come all this way."
"But you are hardly eating at all, Mr. Cosmo, just bread and water."
"I find it helps me think. Now what was it you wanted to—"
"They all like him, Mr. Cosmo. He just talks to people and they like him. And he's really set on dismissing gold. Think of it, sir. Where would we find true worth? He says it's all about the city, but that puts us at the mercy of politicians. It's trickery again."
"A little brandy would do you good, I think," said Cosmo. "And what you say is solid gold's truth, but where is our way forward?"
Bent hesitated. He did not like the lavish family. They crawled over the bank like ivy, but at least they didn't try to change things, and at least they believed in gold. And they weren't silly. Malvolio Bent had a definition of silly that most people would have considered a touch on the broad side. Laughter was silly. Theatricals, poetry, and music were silly. Clothes that weren't grey, black, or at least of undyed cloth were silly. Pictures of things that weren't real were silly. Pictures of things that were real were unnecessary. The ground state of being was silliness, which had to be overcome with every mortal fibre. Missionaries from these stricter religions would have found in Malvolio Bent an ideal convert, except that religion was extremely silly.
Numbers were not silly. Numbers held everything together, and gold was not silly. The Lavishes believed in counting and in gold. Mr. Lipfig treated numbers as if they were something to play with, and he said gold was just lead on holiday. That was more than silly. It was inappropriate behaviour, a scourge that he had torn from his breast after years of struggle. The man had to go. Bent had worked his way up the echelons of the bank over many years, fighting every natural disadvantage, and it hadn't been to see this person make a mockery of it all. No. A man came to the bank again today, he said. He was very odd, and he seemed to know Mr. Lipwig, but he called him Albert Spangler, and talked as if he knew him from long ago, and I think Mr. Lipwig was upset at that. Name of Cribbins, or so he called himself. Very old clothes, very dusty. He made out he was a holy man, but I don't think so.
And that was what was odd, was it?
No, Mr. Cosmo.
Just call me Cosmo, Malcolm. We surely needn't stand on ceremony.
Yes, said Malvolio Bent. Well, no, it wasn't that. It was his teeth. They were those dine-chewers, and they moved and rattled when he spoke, causing him to slurp.
Ah, the old type with the springs, said Cosmo. Very good. And Lipwig was annoyed.
Oh, yes. And the strange thing was, he said he didn't know the man, but he called him by name. Cosmo smiled.
Yes, that is strange. And the man left?
Well, yes, sir, Mr. Cosmo, said Bent. And then I came here.
You have done very well, Matthew. Should the man come in again, could you please follow him and try to find out where he is staying?
If I can, sir, Mr. Cosmo.
Good man.
Cosmo helped Bent out of his chair, shook his hand, waltzed him to the door, opened the door, and ushered him out all in one smooth, balletic movement.
"Hurry back, Mr. Bent. The bank needs you," he said, closing the door. "He's a strange creature, don't you think, Drumknot?"
I wish he'd stop doing that, heretofore thought. Does he think he's veterinary? What do they call those fishes that swim alongside sharks, making themselves useful so they don't get eaten? That's me. That's what I'm doing. Just hanging on because it's much safer than letting go.
How would veterinari find a badly dressed man new to the city with ill-fitting teeth, Drumknot?
Said Cosmo. $50 a month and all found, thought heretofore, snapping out of a brief marine nightmare. Never forget it, and in another few days you're free.
He makes much use of the Beggar's Guild, sir, he said.
Ah, of course. See to it.
There will be expenses, sir.
Yes, Drumknot, I'm conscious of the fact. There are always expenses.
And the other matter? Soon, sir, soon. This is not a job for Cranberry, sir. I'm having to bribe at the highest level,
heretofore coughed.
Silence is expensive, sir.
Moist escorted Adora Bell back to the university in silence. But the important thing was that nothing was broken and no one was killed. Then, as if reaching a conclusion after much careful thought, Adora Bell said, "I worked in a bank for a while, you know, and hardly anyone got stabbed." "I'm sorry, I forgot to warn you, and I did push you out of the way in time. I must admit that the way you threw me to the floor quite turned my head."
"Look, I'm sorry, okay, and so is Amesbury. And now, will you tell me what all this is about? You found four golems, right? Have you brought them back?"
"No.
The tunnel collapsed before we got down that far. I told you they were half a mile down under millions of tons of sand and mud. For what it's worth, we think there was a natural ice dam up in the mountains which burst and flooded half the continent. The stories about say it was destroyed in a flood, so that fits. The golems were washed away with the rubble, which ended up against some chalk cliffs by the sea.
How do you find out they were down there? It's, well, it's nowhere. The usual way.
One of our golems heard one singing. Imagine that. It's been underground for 60,000 years.
In the night under the world, in the pressure of the depth, in the crushing of the dark, a golem sang. There were no words. The song was older than words. It was older than tongues. It was the call of the common clay, and it carried for miles. It travelled along fault lines, made crystals sing in harmony in dark, unmeasured caverns, followed rivers that never saw the sun,
and out of the ground and up the legs of a golem from the Golem Trust, who was pulling a wagon loaded with coal along the Region's One road. When he arrived in Ankh Morpork, he told the Trust. That was what the Trust did. It found golems. Cities, kingdoms, countries came and went, but the golems that Priest had baked from clay and filled with holy fire tended to go on forever. When they had no more orders, no more water to fetch or wood to hew, perhaps because the land was now on the ocean floor or the city was inconveniently under 50 feet of volcanic ash, they did nothing but wait for the next order. They were, after all, property. They obeyed whatever instructions were written on the little scroll in their head. Sooner or later, rock erodes. Sooner or later, a new city would arise. One day there would be orders. Golems had no concept of freedom. They knew they were artifacts. Some even still bore on their clay the finger marks of the long-dead priests. Golems were made to be owned. There had always been a few in Ankh Morpork, running errands, doing chores, pumping water deep underground, unseen and silent and not getting in anyone's way. Then, one day, someone freed a golem by inserting in its head the receipt for the money he'd paid for it, and then he told it that it owned itself. A golem could not be freed by orders, or a war, or a whim, but it could be freed by freehold. When you have been a possession, then you really understand what freedom means in all its magnificent terror. Dorful, the first freed golem, had a plan. He worked hard around the clock he had no time for, and bought another golem. The two golems worked hard and bought a third golem. And now there was the Golem Trust, which bought golems, found golems entombed underground or in the depths of the sea, and helped golems by themselves. In the booming city, golems were worth their weight in gold. They would accept small wages, but they earned them for 24 hours a day. It was still a bargain, stronger than trolls, more reliable than oxen, and more indefatigable and intelligent than both of them. A golem could power every machine in a workshop. This didn't make them popular. There was always a reason to dislike a golem. They didn't drink, eat, gamble, swear, or smile. They worked. If a fire broke out, they hurried to it, en masse, and put it out, and then walked back to what they had been doing. No one knew why a creature that had been baked into life had the urge to do this. But all it won them was a kind of awkward resentment. You couldn't be grateful to an unmoving face with glowing eyes. "How many are down there?" said Moist. "I told you, 4." Moist felt relieved. "Well, that's good. Well done. Can we have a proper celebratory meal tonight, of something the animal wasn't so attached to? And then, who knows?" "There may be a snag," said Adora Bell slowly. "No, really?" "Oh, please," Adora Bell sighed. "Look, the Umnians were the first golem builders, do you understand? Golem legend says that the Umnians invented golems. It's easy to believe, too. Some priest baking a votive offering says the right words, and the clay sits up. It was their only invention. They didn't need any more. Golems built their city. Golems tilled their fields. They invented the wheel, but as a children's toy. They didn't need wheels, you see. You don't need weapons, either, when you've got golems instead of city walls. You don't even need shovels." "You're not going to tell me they built 50-foot-high killer golems, are you?" "Only a man would think of that." "It's our job," said Moist. "If you don't think of 50-foot-high killer golems first, someone else will." "Well, there's no evidence of them," said Adora Bell briskly. "The Umnians never even worked iron. They did work bronze, though." "And gold." There was something about the way that gold was left hanging there that Moist didn't like. "Gold," he said. "Omnian is a very complex language," said Adora Bell quickly. "None of the Trust golems know much about it, so we can't be certain." "Gold," said Moist, his voice leaden. "So, when the digging team found caves down there, we came up with a plan. The tunnel was getting unstable anyway, so they closed it off. We said it had collapsed, and by now the team will have brought the golems out under the sea and be bringing them underwater, all the way into the city," said Adora Bell. Moist pointed at the golem's arm in its bag. "That one isn't gold," he said, hopefully. "We found a lot of golem remains about halfway down," said Adora Bell with a sigh. "The others are deeper. Perhaps because they're heavier." "Gold's
twice the weight of lead, said Moist gloomily. The buried golem is singing in Omnian, which is the most complex language ever, said Adorabelle. I can't be certain of our translation, so I thought let's start by getting them into Ankh Morpork, where they will be safe. Moist took a deep breath. Do you know how much trouble you can get into by breaking a contract with a dwarf?
Oh, come on! I'm not starting a war!
No, you're starting a legal action, and with the dwarfs that's even worse. You told me the contract said you couldn't take precious metals out of the land.
Yes, but these are golems. They're alive.
Look, you've taken, may have taken, all right, may have taken, good grief, tons of gold out of dwarf land. Golem trust land. All right. But there was a covenant, which you broke when you took, didn't take. It walked off by itself, said Adorabelle calmly.
For heaven's sake, only a woman could think like this. You think because you believe there's a perfectly good justification for your actions, the legal issues don't matter. And here am I, this close to persuading people here that a dollar doesn't have to be round and shiny, and I'm finding that at any minute four big, shiny, beaming golems are going to stroll into town, waving and glittering at everybody.
There's no need to get hysterical, said Adorabelle.
Yes, there is. What there isn't a need for is staying calm.
Yes. But that's when you come alive, right? That's when your brain works best. You always find a way, right?
And there was nothing you could do about a woman like that. She just turned herself into a hammer, and you ran right into her.
Fortunately.
They'd reached the entrance to the university. Above them loomed the forbidding statue of Alberto Malik, the founder. It had a chamber pot on its head. This had inconvenienced the pigeon, which, by family tradition, spent most of its time perched on Alberto's head, and now wore on its own head a miniature version of the same pottery receptacle.
Must be rag week again, thought Moist. Students, eh? Love them or hate them, you're not allowed to hit them with a shovel.
Look, golems or not, let's have dinner tonight, just you and me up in the suite. Amesbury would love it. He doesn't often get a chance to cook for humans, and it'd make him feel better. He'll do anything you want, I'm sure.
Adorabelle gave him a lopsided look.
I thought you'd suggest that, so I ordered sheep's head. He was overjoyed.
Sheep's head, said Moist gloomily.
You know I hate food that stares back. I won't even look a sardine in the face.
He promised to blindfold it.
Oh, good.
My granny made a wonderful sheep's head mould, said Adorabelle. That's where you use pig's trotters to thicken the broth, so that when it gets cold you
know... Sometimes there's such a thing as too much information, said Moist.
This evening, then. Now let's go and see your dead wizard. You should enjoy it. There's bound to be skulls.
There were skulls. There were black drapes. There were complex symbols drawn on the floor. There were spirals of incense from black thuribles. And in the middle of all this, the head of post-mortem communications, in a fearsome mask, was fiddling with a candle.
He stopped when he heard them come in, and straightened up hurriedly.
"Oh, you're early,"
he said, his voice somewhat muffled by the fangs. "Sorry, it's the candles. They should be cheap tallow for the proper black smoke, but wouldn't you know it, they've given me beeswax. I told them just dribbling is no good to me. Acrid smoke is what we want, or what they want, anyway. Sorry, John Hicks, head of department, Ponder has told me all about you."
He took off the mask and extended a hand. The man looked as though he tried, like any self-respecting necromancer, to grow a proper goatee beard, but owing to some basic lack of malevolence, it had turned out a bit sheepish. After a few seconds, Hicks realized why they were staring, and pulled off the fake rubber hand with the black fingernails.
"I thought necromancy was banned," said Moist.
"Oh, we don't do necromancy here," said Hicks. "What made you think that?"
Moist looked around at the furnishings, shrugged, and said,
"Well, I suppose it first crossed my mind when I saw the way the paint was flaking off the door, and you can still just see a crude skull and the letters NEC—"
ancient history," said Hicks quickly. "We are the Department of Post-Mortem Communications. Necromancy, on the other hand, is a very bad form of magic done by evil wizards.
And since you are not evil wizards, what you are doing can't be called necromancy."
"Exactly."
"And, what defines an evil wizard?" said Adorabelle.
"Well, Doing necromancy would definitely be there, right on top of the list.
Could you just remind us what you are going to do?
We're going to talk to the late Professor Fleed, said Hicks.
Who is dead, yes?
Very much so. Extremely dead.
Isn't that just a tiny bit like necromancy?
Ah, but, you see, for necromancy you require skulls and bones and a general necropolitan feel, said Dr. Hicks.
He looked at their expressions.
Ah, I see where you're going wrong, he said with a little laugh that cracked a bit around the edges. Don't be deceived by appearances. I don't need all this. Professor Fleed does. He's a bit of a traditionalist, and wouldn't get out of his urn for anything less than the full rite of souls, complete with the dread mask of summoning. He twanged a fang.
And that's the dread mask of summoning, is it? Said Moist.
The wizard hesitated for a moment before saying,
Of course.
Only it looks just like the dread sorcerer mask they sell in Boffo's shop in 10th Egg Street, said Moist. Excellent value at $5, I thought.
I think you must be mistaken, said Hicks.
I don't think so, said Moist. You left the label on.
Where?
The I'm not a necromancer at all snatched up the mask and turned it over in his hands, looking for...
He saw Moist's grin and rolled his eyes.
All right, yes, he muttered. We lost the real one. Everything gets lost round here. You just wouldn't believe it. They're not clearing up the spells properly.
Was there a huge squid in the corridor?
Not this afternoon, said Adorabelle.
Yes, what's the reason for the squid? Oh, let me tell you about the squid, said Hicks.
Yes.
You don't want to know about the squid.
We don't.
Believe me. Are you sure it wasn't there?
It's the sort of thing you notice, said Adorabelle.
With any luck, that one's worn off then, said Hicks, relaxing. It really is getting impossible. Last week, everything in my filing cabinet filed itself under W. No one seems to know why.
And you were going to tell us about the skulls, said Adorabelle.
All fake, said Hicks.
Excuse me?
The voice was dry and crackly and came from the shadows in the far corner.
Apart from Charlie, of course, Hicks added hurriedly. He's been here forever.
I'm the backbone of the department, said the voice a shade proudly.
Look, shall we get started? Said Hicks, rummaging in a black velvet sack. There are some hooded black robes on the hook behind the door. They're just for show, of course, but post-mortem communications is all about theatre, really. Most of the people we communicate with are wizards, and frankly, they don't like change.
We're not going to do anything ghoulish, are we? Said Adorabelle, looking at a robe doubtfully.
Apart from talk to someone who's been dead for 300 years, said Moist. He was not naturally at ease in the presence of skulls. Humans have been genetically programmed not to be ever since monkey times because, A, whatever turned that skull into a skull might still be around and you should head for a tree now, and B, skulls look like they're having a laugh at one's expense.
Don't worry about that, said Hicks, taking a small ornamental jar out of the black bag and polishing it on his sleeve. Professor Fleed willed his soul to the university. He's a bit crabby, I have to say, but he can be cooperative if we put on a decent show.
He stood back.
Let's see. Grizzly candles, circle of Nemereth, glass of silent time, the mask, of course, the curtains of, curtains, and,
here he put a small box down beside the bottle,
the vital ingredients.
Sorry, do you mean all those expensive-sounding other things aren't vital, said Moist.
They're more like scenery, said Hicks, adjusting the hood. I mean, we could all sit around reading the script out loud, but without the costumes and scenery, who'd want to turn up?
Are you interested in the theatre at all? He added, in a hopeful voice.
I go when I can, said Moist, guardedly, because he recognised the hope in the man's voice.
You didn't by any chance see Tis Pity She's an Instructor in Unarmed Combat at the Little Theatre recently? It's put on by the Dolly Sisters Players?
No, I'm afraid not.
I played Sir Andrew Fartswell, said Dr. Hicks, in case Moist was due a sudden attack of recollection.
Oh, that was you, was it? Said Moist, who'd met actors before. Everyone at work was talking about it. I'm okay as long as he doesn't ask which night they talked about, he thought. There's always one night in every play when something hilariously dreadful happens. But he was lucky. An experienced actor knows when not to push his luck. Instead, Hicks said,
Do you know ancient languages?
I can do basic droning, said Moist.
I can speak formal golem,
"Is this ancient enough for you?" said Adora Bell, and made Moist's spine tingle. The private language of the golems was usually hell on the human tongue, but it sounded unbearably sexy when Adora Bell uttered it. It was like silver in the air.
"What was that?"
said Hicks. "The common language of golems for the last 20,000 years, said Adora Bell.
"Really? Most, moving. We'll begin."
In the counting house, no one dared to look up as the desk of the chief cashier rumbled around on its turntable like some ancient tumbril. Papers flew under Malvolio Bent's hands, while his brain drowned in poisons and his feet treadled continually to release the dark energies choking his soul. He didn't calculate, not as other men saw it. Calculation was for people who couldn't see the answer turning gently in their head. To see was to know. It always had been. The mound of accumulated paperwork dwindled as the fury of his thinking racked him. There were new accounts being opened all the time, and why? Was it because of trust, probity, an urge toward thrift? Was it because of anything that could be called worth? No. It was because of Lipvig. People whom Mr. Bent had never seen before and hoped never to see again were pouring into the bank, their money in boxes, their money in piggy banks, and quite often their money in socks. Sometimes they were actually wearing the socks. And they were doing this because of words. The bank's coffers were filling up because the wretched Mr. Lipvig made people laugh and made people hope. People liked him. No one had ever liked Mr. Bent, as far as he was aware. Oh, there had been a mother's love and a father's arms, the one chilly, the other too late. But where had they got him? In the end, he'd been left alone. So he'd run away and found the grey caravan and entered a new life based on numbers and on worth and solid respect. And he'd worked his way up, and yes, he was a man of worth, and yes, he had respect. Yes, respect. Even Mr. Cosmo respected him. And now here was Lipvig. And who was he? No one seemed to know, except for the suspicious man with the unstable teeth. One day there was no Lipvig, next day he was the Postmaster General, and now he was in the bank, a man whose worth was in his mouth, and who showed no respect for anyone. And he made people laugh, and the bank filled up with money. "And did the Lavishes lavish anything on you?" said a familiar little voice in his head. It was a hated little part of himself that he had beaten and starved and punched back into its wardrobe for years. It wasn't the voice of his conscience. He was the voice of his conscience. It was the voice of the mask. "No," snapped Bent. Some of the nearest clerks looked up at the unaccustomed noise and then hurriedly lowered their heads for fear of catching his eye. Bent stared fixedly at the sheet in front of him, watching the numbers roll past. "Rely on the numbers. They didn't let you down. Cosmo doesn't respect you, you fool. You fool! You have run their bank for them and cleaned up after them. You made, they spent, and they laugh at you. You know they do. Silly Mr. Bent with his funny walk. Silly, silly, silly. Get away from me! Get away!" he whispered. "The people like him because he likes them. No one likes Mr. Bent." "But I have worth. I have value." Mr. Bent pulled another worksheet toward himself and sought solace in its columns. But he was pursued. "Where was your worth and value when you made the numbers dance, Mr. Bent? The innocent numbers? You made them dance and somersault and cartwheel when you cracked your whip. And they danced into the wrong places, didn't they? Because Sir Joshua demanded his price. Where did the gold dance off to, Mr. Bent? Smoke and mirrors." "No!" In the counting house, all the pens ceased moving for a few seconds before scribbling again with frantic activity. Eyes watering with shame and rage, Mr. Bent tried to unscrew the top from his patent fountain pen. In the muted silence of the banking hall, the sound of the green pen being deployed had the same effect as the sound of the axeman sharpening his blade. Every clerk bent low to his desk. Mr. Bent had found a mistake. All anyone could do was keep their eyes on the paper in front of them and hope against hope that it was not theirs. Someone, and please gods it would not be them, would have to go and stand in front of the high desk. They knew that Mr. Bent did not like mistakes. Mr. Bent believed that mistakes were the result of a deformity of the soul. At the sound of the pen of doom, one of the senior clerks hurried to Mr. Bent's side. Those workers who risked being turned to water by the ferocity of Mr. Bent's stare essayed a quick glance and saw her being shown the offending document. There was a distant tut-tut sound. Her tread, as she came down the steps and crossed the floor, echoed in deadly, praying silence. She did not know, as she scurried, button boots flashing, to the desk of one of the youngest and newest clerks, that she was about to meet a young man who was destined to go down in history as one of the great heroes of banking.